schwebt wie Duft dahin. Und schwebt wie Duft dahin. Doch kommt das Wort und fasst es und führt es vor das Auge, wie nebelgraue Blast es und schwindet wie ein Hauch.
I wonder if it occurred to Edwin Fischer and Walter Gieseking when they recorded Lieder with Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, or Wilhelm Furtwängler when he played a Salzburg recital for her, with the piano lid wide open, overpowering the superb singing, that they were not giving this artist the support she would have had from a man dedicated to this type of music making. Well, we've been hearing Gerald Moore describe the challenge that a pianist faces when performing with a singer. His memoir, appropriately, is called Am I Too Loud? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What we've been hearing musically is neither Gerald Moore nor any of the performers that he mentioned. We're hearing Warren Jones at the piano. He has 50 years of performance to his credit and has recorded with Barbara Bonney and Håkan Hagegard, as now, Samuel Ramey, Kiri Takanawa, and others, has performed with many, in fact. When is the pianist performing with a singer more than just an accompanist? And how much does the pianist affect the way a piece is performed? Does the pianist ever get to steal the show? Our guest is Warren Jones.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm curious because I can't imagine that too many people grow up thinking, I'm going to be an accompanist. You know, that they might start heading for a career as a concert pianist, a soloist, a virtuoso. But at what point did you decide, I'm going to be an accompanist?
Well, let's see. I suppose we should straighten out the word first.
Okay.
Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm a pianist. So we can talk about that later on,
okay,
if you like. But I knew that I wanted to be a pianist from a fairly early age. I mean, the first thing I wanted to be was a professional baseball player because my grandfather had a contract with the Pittsburgh Pirates back before World War I and was never able to play because he got called into the war and never got to, you know, play for the ball club. I wanted to be a right fielder as he was, but my eyesight and several other things got in the way of that. And eventually, where I was studying piano, and it became clear that I was good at that and I enjoyed doing it. And I was interested in a lot of other different things, but when it came time to go off to school, I was advised very strongly by my high school band director and also by my piano teacher that I should go to a music conservatory, not to a university, and just concentrate on playing the piano, and which is what I did. I applied to other places, but I eventually went to New England Conservatory in Boston. And while I was there, I fastidiously tried to get as broad an education inside the conservatory as I could. I had sort of narrowed it down to three basic choices of career. They were, in no particular order, solo piano playing, teaching, and making music with other people. And by the time I was about a junior in college, it had become clear to me that solo piano playing was not where my personality is.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, and that has everything to do with it as far as I'm concerned. Solo piano playing is an incredibly solitary occupation. It requires a different kind of ego than I have. I mean, I have a pretty healthy ego, but I don't have that kind of ego in the sense that I regard making music with other people as it's quite like the electrical system on a car. A spark originates the system working, the spark coming from a battery in the car, and immediately the apparatus, the engine, begins to recharge the battery so that the electrical system stays intact and vital. And that's much the same way that I regard music making with other people. One's battery, while one gives out the spark initially, or someone in the process gives out the spark, everyone's battery is constantly getting charged by everyone else's activities. And so I walk away from performances quite fulfilled and not spent, as it were. And in fact, I usually am more energetic after I've played the piano than before I started.
You are revealing something of your origins in that conceit that you used about automotive energy. Is that something that came to you back when you were working at the gas station there in High Point, North Carolina?
No, not particularly. I mean, it's just a perfect example. I am glad I understand how the electrical system in my car works, because sometimes when things go wrong, you have to, you know, if you're out on the highway, you need to know what's going on. But no, that's just an example for me of how different stuff in life informs our music making and or our artistic activities. Art doesn't exist by itself. It's a vital, red-blooded thing that living people do, and they have living experiences. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been doing other things and realized something musical in the middle of it. I mean, even to the point that I'm talking about, for example, like, oh, chopping wood. I love to chop wood. It's one of my, believe it or not, it's one of my favorite activities.
I enjoy it too. I don't remember getting any musical ideas.
Is it the rhythm?
What is it?
It's partly the rhythm. It has to do with understanding the texture of the log in front of you. And when you put the log up, when you put the piece of wood up on the block, looking at it and seeing where to strike it to get the desired effect, and understanding how the energy flows through the wood and stuff like that. I mean, if you've done it very much, you can look at a piece of wood and see if it's going to be easy to split or not.
Yeah.
You know?
It's got those big knots in an oak log. That's very different from a nice piece of pine.
Exactly. The first time I chopped pine, I thought, this is like toothpicks, because I'm used to chopping oak.
which is nastier stuff. And I guess something about finding, if you're thinking of a sawing metaphor, finding the groove when you're when you're making music and getting the feel of it.
Exactly.
Well, let me come back to that word that I used, accompanist. When I used to play oboe, my father would accompany me. He would joke with me, so are you ready to accompany me? You know, that he was going to be, if we did a sonata. At what point?
Well, he was your father. That's why he could say
joke with me. But if you are this famous accompanist to famous singers, you don't get equal billing, right?
I do, in fact.
You do get equal billing. All right.
But the
accompanying, when is it? So it's not ever accompanying.
As far as I'm concerned, it's not. We make music together. I mean, making music is an active process. It's not a reactive process. There's not time to react in making music. Two or three or four or five people, or how many ever people, even if it's an orchestra, get together, and ideally, they participate together going forward and doing their thing, and the result comes out as music. But it's not. There's nothing reactive about it. See, accompanying, to me, the word establishes a certain hierarchy mm-hmm. about how things are working, mm-hmm. and they're not working like that. It's for the. That's for the same reason, for example, that I refuse professionally to teach music, to teach the music to someone that I'm performing with. I won't do that, because the minute that this, if it's a singer, for example, the minute that the singer comes in and wants to learn a song with me, there's just that action alone has set up a hierarchy in the room that is inevitably going to be there. And I'm not interested in having that kind of hierarchy about it, because I'm interested for them to learn what they're learning and I learn what I learn. And then we come and we exchange ideas, and that's what rehearsing is. Rehearsing is not about teaching. Teaching is a whole different thing. I engage in teaching all the time with young pianists and young singers, but not with people that I perform with, because I'm not interested in having a hierarchical, is that a word, structure involved in the whole thing, involved in the whole process.
Well, do you have a piece that you could point us to that would show a perfect sort of partnership between you and a singer?
Well, I particularly like this piece. I know you have a copy of it, of Evening Song by Charles Griffiths. This particular song is on a poem by the American poet Sidney Lanier, who is one of my favorite poets.
Southern poet.
Exactly. And Griffiths said it in the most remarkable way, and there's a recording that you have of Samuel Ramey and me performing. I love this piece very much.
Evening Song by Charles Tomlinson Griffiths. The bass was Samuel Ramey, the pianist Warren Jones, and they were in concert at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris in 1995.
With what a beautiful blend.
Some unusual American sounds, yes.
I love the music of Griffiths. That's one of my favorite American composers. I'm fascinated by his life and very fascinated by his career, such as it was, and I'm incredibly fascinated by the way he passed from this planet, which was very unfortunate. At a fairly young age, I think he must have been just over 30, I believe. But his sensibility and his compositions are unbelievably inventive to me.
Another composer who died early, George Gershwin, I think 38, you've recorded some Gershwin songs. Is there one that we could hear that illustrates something else about your work? Is it?
Oh, sure. There's a song which is a favorite of mine because it reveals wonderful good humor, and especially in today's politics. There's a song called It's Just Another Rumba, which is the story of a man who unfortunately takes a vacation in Havana and comes away with the rumba in his ear, and he is unable to function because of the rumba. You would even think that the song stops at a certain point, but then the rumba starts up again, and he can't help. He has to keep singing and keep going. So.
As a relapse.
And this is with Samuel Ramey again?
Also with Samuel Ramey, yes.
It happened to me on a trip to the West Indies. Now I'm all at sea since that trip to the West Indies. I'm jittery, I'm twittery, I guess I'm done for, I guess I'm through. And it's something about which there's nothing anyone can do. It isn't love, it isn't money trouble, it's a very funny trouble. it's just another rumble. But it certainly has my number. So much so that I can't eat or slumber. Can you imagine anything dumber? Why did I have to plan a vacation in Havana? What made me take that trip that made me lose my grip? Oh, that piece of music laid me low. There it goes again, just another rumba, which I heard only last September. I'm a wreck. Why did I have to succumb? Can you imagine anything dumber? Why did I have to succumb to that bumba? Swing and hot chop. At first it was divine, but it turned out a Cuban Frankenstein. It got me by the throat. Oh, what's the antidote? It brought me woe and strife. It made me lose my wife. It's the rumba that blighted my life. Again, just another rumba, which has got me under its thumb. So much so that I can't eat or slumber. Can you imagine anything dumber? Why did I have to succumb to that?
That was Gershwin's Just Another Rumba with Samuel Ramey and Warren Jones at the piano, our guest. Back in a moment with more University of the Year.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, call 800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Warren Jones, a pianist who performs with many of the great singers of our time. We've been hearing from Samuel Ramey, for example, the great bass, and as long as we're on an American string here. I know that you have recorded also with Samuel Ramey a series of songs by that American original, let's say, Charles Ives. Are there particular challenges or invitations in the often angular music of Ives?
Well, there are actually, but Ives made a very interesting comment in an essay that he wrote about his music one time. He said, just because people can't play it doesn't mean that I shouldn't write it. And if you think about it, for example, when the Beethoven Ninth Symphony was put down in front of the orchestra, it was ruled out as unplayable music.
Many
and
great
now
works, yeah.
Every community orchestra puts on the Beethoven Ninth Symphony when they need money. They get together a chorus and put on a big old performance that was for soloists. And, you know, everyone can play it. Ives is the same way. I remember when I recorded these Ives songs, there are a few of them where there are literally too many notes for human hands to cover. I called up the man who has turned out to be my last regular piano teacher, who is now departed from the planet, and I said to him, Milton, what do I do if I get in and a producer wants all this played? I mean, what am I going to suggest to him to, you know, that we should overdub it or track it or something like that? And he said, do what you want to do. You're the piano player. Just play what you want to play and tell him to rough it.
Good advice.
Then that worked. It worked.
Is that what you're up to in something like, and this is a classic Ives title, the circus band? Is that one of those things where there's two or three things going on at once?
Well, the circus band is an interesting piece because it's the viewpoint of a five-year-old child told by an adult who remembers the band coming. And the kid is waiting by the side of the street, waiting as the parade goes by. And he sees various things. He sees cowboys and he sees a beauty queen and all kinds of, you know, floats and what have you. And then you hear the drum rolls in the piano, which are denoted by sort of clusters on the keyboard that are played in rhythm. And you hear the band start coming. You know, you hear this thing. And he's talking about there's one woman in front of the band that he wonders if she will, because apparently she's very pretty, and he wonders if she'll remember the fact that he waved at her the year before. And there are a series of small, like one-word phrases, and the child's bitterly disappointed because the woman walks right by and doesn't pay any attention. And the band, in the meantime, has become entirely overpowering because the trombones come up, and you hear, I believe in this recording, I actually am the one who yells, hear the trombones, and the trombones start to play, and it gets pretty loud. Of course, with Sam Raimi singing, you can play pretty loud, and still he's still heard. It's no problem.
Just the two of you doing right. All of this.
Wow. Exactly. So this is The Circus Band by Charles Ives.
Horses are prancing, knights advancing, helmets gleaming, pennants streaming, Cleopatra's on her throne, that golden hair is all her own. Horses are prancing, knights advancing, helmets gleaming, pennants streaming, Cleopatra's on her throne, that golden hair. Last year she waved to me, I think. Can she have died? Can that rot? She is passing, but she sees me not.
Charles Ives, he was never far from his sense of humor, and particularly in something like The Circus Band. This is a question I shouldn't ask, but the style of that music makes me wonder, have you ever considered playing for silent films?
Have I ever done that? Let's see. I don't believe I've ever done silent films, but it would be fun.
Well, I have to ask you something else, which nobody can see since this is radio, but I was fascinated by the fact that as we were listening, instead of seeing your hands move along with yourself, kind of remembering what you played on the keyboard, you're actually mouthing the words that Samuel Raimi sang In other words, you've made his part your part as well. Is that part of sort of your concept of a real joint performance?
Oh, well, yes. You know, it's imperative to know that any kind of song literature, any kind of music that involves words, the music is composed as a reaction to a poem or some set of words, maybe some prose or something like that. I know of only one piece of music that I – major piece of music that I know, and that's one of the sets of Liebeslieder waltzes, where Brahms wrote the waltzes and then words were written to fit those. But every other piece that I know, the composer got the words or picked out the words, and what we hear are the composer's more or less ruminations on the text. And so in order to understand the music, the first thing to do is to understand the words. And that involves memorizing the words to me. And I enjoy memorizing words mm-hmm. because it's a game I play with myself. And by my understanding the words and my understanding my own reaction to the words, I can begin to fathom what a composer meant with his reactions to the words. So it's an integral part of learning the music and performing.
Do you play with a score?
I perform by memory sometimes, probably less right now than I did 5 years ago because I'm busier. And I have, in order to have whole programs in my head, because most weeks I'm playing most weeks I play two or three different programs a week. And that doesn't mean performances. I mean two or three
different
programs.
Sets of music.
That's
yes.
right. And that's a little much for my walnut-sized brain to keep together. So, but if I can, I like to play without the music.
And what about the special challenges of working with a vocalist as opposed to if we were listening to a piece where you were playing with a violinist or a cellist?
Well, let's see.
I mean, obviously the words, as you just mentioned, knowing the words of the text are crucial in a way that they would not be if you were accompanying a violinist.
Well, I'll tell you, with my students at Manhattan School, I teach at Manhattan School in New York City, my students there, the crucial question that is asked in every audition that I have to study with me, I ask people if they like singers. Now, that doesn't mean do they like singing, do they like Schubert, do they like Puccini, do they like the voice, do they like singers, because singers are a breed unto themselves.
We're talking ego, you mean the prima
donna? No, it's not about that. It's about the fact that they live by nature. They live on the edge, and they are incredibly vulnerable in what they're doing. And so it's required that if you are with them, you have to be a comforting, non-threatening presence around them. Because when they're threatened, they will just withdraw. They just withdraw into their shell and they won't come out. They just won't come out. They have to feel free to express themselves. You have to remember, I mean, imagine your job or any job. For example, imagine if you were a lawyer and you stood up and gave an argument in front of court for a very important client where there was a lot of money on the line, okay? And then you sat down at the table and were immediately critiqued by the person sitting next to you who told you how that had sounded. Because you have no idea how that sounded or how you came across. You had no idea what you looked like. Singers operate, practically speaking, in the dark. If you've ever spoken into any kind of recording device, you know that your voice does not sound like what you think it sounds like. Mine doesn't sound like what I think it sounds like. We hear it from the inside out. And singers are engaged in that all the time. They engage in a trust exercise with the people around them constantly, and they are easily squashed.
Well, I suppose it is the most personal form of music making because what they're doing is literally playing their body,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like that, then that's pretty hard on a singer.
It's also very intangible. I mean, the psychology of doing it is quite amazing because they can't take it out and look at it. You know, it's going
it so easily.
That's right. They have no idea. They can't manipulate it with their hands. I mean, I'm unabashed about the fact that I play a machine. I deal with a machine. In today's world, the piano is an incredibly crude machine. The industrial tolerances on a piano are wide compared to what most mm-hmm. machines work like. And I manipulate the machine. And the modern piano, a good modern piano, is an incredibly reflective machine of the subtlety of the person playing it, but nonetheless it's a crude machine. But it's sitting there in front of me, and I have the feeling, literally when I'm playing, of being the battery that I hook on. I literally hook myself to it with my two hands and my two feet, and I make it go. You know, the piano doesn't have anything. It has no music in it. It has no possibility. It's just a translation device for the music that's inside me. And I have to have it in order to make that kind of music. A singer is a self-contained entity walking around with all that stuff going on inside them. Inside them, not outside them. A violinist can look, can see the bow, the contact point on the string and what have you. You know, a trumpet player feels the metal in his hands and feels the pistons going up and down in the valves and stuff like that. You know, singers are working in this intangible, wacky world that they live in. And so they're neurotic. Most of them, almost all of them are neurotic with very good reason, with very good reason. And you have to love that type of personality that has the nerve, that has the courage to get up and do that. It takes a huge amount of courage.
Do you approach performing with a soprano any differently than you would playing with a bass?
That depends on how the music is written, because the biggest problem, or let's see, I work in California during the summer, so I'll use the California term. The biggest opportunity that I have is I have to be aware of the register of the area on the piano in which the singer is singing. Because, for example, if a tenor is singing the same song as a soprano, the tenor is going to sing one octave lower than the soprano would, generally speaking. Sam, for example, sings things two octaves lower than a soprano would. Okay, but, for example, a tenor and a mezzo-soprano may sing in the same octave the same song. They may. Okay, but even when they do that, the overtones in their voice are entirely different. And the challenge at the keyboard is to literally stay out of their way sonically. So, for example, if a singer is singing in the middle of my right hand, then the middle of my right hand has to recede a little bit just to let them through.
Wow.
I see. Quite a subtlety.
Oh, well, it's quite something.
And is there a soprano sample we could listen to of a piece that you especially love?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Maybe from a recording with Ruth Ann Swenson. There's one song that I love particularly very much called Lodekskis, which Ruth Ann sings very beautifully. And, you know, Ruth Ann is a profiling courage. You know, she has just finished a treatment for a very invasive breast cancer. And she just, if I can say this now, she just came back and sang two performances of the Metropolitan Opera, which were her first two back after her treatments. And she sounds wonderful. She's really doing great.
That's great.
So this is from a recording that we made a few years ago, which shows everything wonderful that that woman does with her voice. I mean, it's quite amazing to listen to.
Thank you.
Music by Rinaldo Hahn, L'Orchis, with Ruth Ann Swenson, soprano, and Warren Jones at the piano. Have you ever wondered when you hear a voice that's really beautiful, do I really need to be here?
I had a moment several years ago about 3 years ago in Gainesville, Florida, where I was doing a concert with Kiri Takanawa. And I was playing those concerts by memory. And we were doing the Rachmaninoff Vocalese, which, you know, is a wordless song. And the third phrase in that evening, I mean, I've heard Kiri sing a lot in all different kinds of repertory and all different kinds of settings and what have you. And the third phrase in that evening, I will never forget it, because a tone came out of her mouth that was just otherworldly, incredibly beautiful. And it just immobilized me. I couldn't play the piano. I mean, I just stopped playing and took my hands off the keys. There was not anything to do. And I just put my hands in my lap. And she sang for a little bit longer and then sort of stopped and turned around. And I just looked at her and I said, I cannot play. That's so beautiful. You know, I can't do this. And it's the only time in my 50 years in public, because this year is my 50th year of playing the piano in public, it's the only time I've ever stopped in public for any reason. I mean, and I've done wacky things on stage. I've cut my fingers on stage and bled all over the keyboard. I've had flowers fall on me, you know, vases of flowers. I've had all different kinds of stuff happen, but I had never stopped. But that evening, I stopped cold. There was nothing to do. I was a blank. I was entirely taken away.
Well, no. Testimony to the power of music.
It is, for sure.
More in a moment when we continue with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Warren Jones, pianist who's recorded with a lot of the world's most famous singers. Looking at the list of CD tracks and the different songs that you've recorded, I'm struck by the range. You know, everything from medieval songs to Gershwin and all over the place. Are there songs in particular that stand out to you because of their political power? Mentioned that the Rachmaninoff, that was not even a word, it was the actual tone, the sound. But what about sometimes when you're performing where the words themselves kind of hit you?
Oh, well, there's a lot of songs like that. I mean, I think about, for example, one CD that you have, the one that has a song cycle on it called Genius Child with words by Langston Hughes, the American poet and writer. The songs are, as far as I'm concerned, the poems are unabashedly political. I don't know that much about Hughes. You might know better about this.
Hughes.
I'm not convinced that they were written with politics in mind, but I'm convinced that, because I think they were a personal expression first, but when you consider his situation in life, they become inescapably political.
Right.
I think.
Oh,
I don't
yes.
know. I mean, but I'm not convinced. They're not political poetry per se. You know what I mean?
Is that the kind of thing you would discuss with a performer such as Marilyn Blackwell, with whom you recorded this? Or how do you come at something like a poem?
Well, Marilyn is an African-American lady, and so she is very well equipped to understand that herself. If anything, I'm the one who needed the explanation, which I don't think someone could explain that to me until they're blue in the face, and I won't get it because I don't have that skin color. I don't have that gender. I don't know anything about that. It's not possible. I can understand it mentally. There's not any way to know about it. You know, there's just not.
Well, let's hear the power of what the two of you do together with the setting of Langston Hughes' Genius Child by Ricky Ian Gordon.
This is a song for the genius child. Sing it softly, for the song is mild. Sing it softly as ever you can. Does the song get out of hand? Nobody loves a genius child. Can you love an eagle tail? Name.
And when you're performing something like that, what do you as a performer do specifically for a composition like that in terms of the combination of the music, the politics of the words?
Well, part of it has to do with, you know, whether my reading of the text is – if my understanding of the text, I look for something in the music that resonates with me from the music, you understand, so that I have something that I can bring out of the music to amplify out of the music. There are a lot of times where composers set poems where when I listen to the music, there's not any way for me to get that. Because I think, for example, especially of a poem which is very popular right now, which has been set by a lot of current contemporary American composers, as well as some earlier ones, the Emily Dickinson poem, Will There Really Be a Morning, which I find to be an incredibly dark poem. When you think about how what Dickinson's life was like and the fact that some of those nights were so long in that house and what have you, and some people, there are some composers who have written that music to sound incredibly optimistic and happy, like morning's going to be fabulous and stuff like that. And the question is this ever going to end? It's not about the morning. It's about, you know, but some composers, as far as I'm concerned, they literally miss it, okay? And I don't want to play that music because I don't see how I can bring something to that, frankly.
So the text kind of takes precedence over the composition. In other words, if you have a sort of direct connection to the Emily Dickinson poem and you feel somebody's getting it wrong, you'd sort of...
Well, it's hard to do. Yeah. I mean, it's practically impossible to do that. I tell people, again, I don't know if y'all think about music this way or not, but my job or music performers' jobs is it's roughly analogous to taking a blind person to an art gallery and showing them, for example, oh, one of the haystack paintings of Monet. You know, if you stand in front of the haystack painting and describe the haystack to a blind person, you have to remember that that person is existing in an entirely different context than sighted people. And so, for example, they may understand the feel of the hay. They may understand the feel of the wind blowing in their face. But I know they probably won't understand the concept of blue sky because they haven't seen blue. And so one has to search for a common way of expressing blue sky or that, you know, sunlight, for example. It's not enough to say that the day is light. I found the commonality is about the warmth of the light. It's not about the brightness of the light. It's about how the light makes me feel. And so I have to look, when I'm interpreting something like Genius Child or any number of other songs, I have to look for some kind of common experience that I can express to the listener so that they can actually get what's there, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, it's a very interesting, it's an incredibly fascinating thing to me to be doing that.
I'm never going to call you an accompanist again.
certainly sounds like a tough assignment, one that not just everybody could bring off. A really common problem, it seems to me, with a lot of singers who are very well trained is when they go to sing a simple song like maybe something like Gershwin or even something more pop than that, they just way over-sing it.
Right. Well, my own practice at the piano, most of – you know, practicing is an interesting exercise because practicing is about facing the truth. When I sit down at the keyboard, I have to, on many levels, find the truth. And that means I have to the best of my ability, understand what is the truth about the words? What is the truth about the music? What is the truth about the machine that I'm sitting in front of right now? And then it gets personal. What is the truth about me? What is the truth about how I feel about that? What is the truth about my technical abilities at the piano, et cetera? And it's a constant look at the truth. And what it amounts to is removing obstacles to the truth and getting to the truth. Now, the reason I say that is because a lot of singers, it's not only singers, a lot of performers who engage in overdoing things, it's because they have not yet gotten to the bottom of the bottom of the matter and removed all that stuff that will allow them to just play simply or sing simply. They think that there's a lot of dressing, a lot of window dressing that has to go on top of it, that they have to apply their voice in a certain way, or they have to apply their violin sound in a certain way, or, you know, the sonority of the piano in a certain way, when often it's just a question of just simply doing it. But as you know, sometimes the simplest things are the hardest things.
So true. Do you sing when you rehearse a piece, practice a
absolutely.
Piece?
Absolutely.
You
absolutely.
Sing them
do you sing well?
Oh, how does that go
practicing,
for you?
Practicing is a very raucous, a very raucous passage of time.
Now, you gave some anecdotes.
I mean, it's loud. It gets on and I curse and scream and stomp and shout and get up and get mad. And, you know, and then I sit back down and sort of calm down and play again and all that stuff.
Emotion, recollection, and tranquility.
That's right. You gave some anecdotes about vases falling on you, cut fingers and that kind of thing. What about the anecdotes that have to do with something that happened to the singer where you had to respond, had to adjust?
Oh, stuff that's happened to singers, let's see, in a performance. Oh, none come immediately to my mind. There is that story that I've told about the lady at the University of Kansas one time, very well-known soprano, who between the slips in her memory in a performance of a Handel aria and then her willingness to improvise, that became quite an experience on the stage, and especially the fact that to this day I don't believe that she realizes either of those things was happening. She just thought that she had thrown in a note or two. And it was an interesting time for me. That's true, you know.
So you became a composer of sorts.
A little bit, yeah, exactly. There have been other things that have happened. For example, I went on stage at the University of Illinois one time with a very well-known mezzo-soprano who was poured into the dress that she had on, and she's a very shapely lady and very beautiful in that dress. And I played the first chord of a recitative. She took the first breath and popped the entire zipper out of the back of the dress. I mean, the dress literally came apart, and she's standing there holding up her dress, and I looked at the audience and said, "We're going to be back in a few minutes, but we have a wardrobe problem here." So we sort of backed off the stage, and, you know, I sort of covered up her back with my coat. And
what do you sing coming back out from a deal like that, I wonder?
Oh, well, never mind.
Shall we go out with a song?
Please.
We haven't heard yet, except at the very beginning, from your collaborations with Håkon Hagegard. So what would be a nice thing to hear the two of you perform?
Well, one of my favorite songs is a song called En Sourdine, which means muted, is the best way you can translate that. And it's a picture of a couple lying on the forest floor. They've made love, and they're in that wonderful afterglow, and they're talking about hearing the nightingale sing. And, you know, the nightingale in a lot of Western literature is indicative of something going wrong. And so you are left with the idea that this is going to be their last time together, and or may well be their last time together. And it's an overarching, beautiful song, which I love to play and hear Håkon sing. Sœur et doux qui vient.
Håkon Haggegard, the baritone, Warren Jones, the pianist, equal partners in a performance of a song with implied parting in it, En Sourdine by Gabriel Fauré. And our guest this hour has been pianist Warren Jones. What a treat.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4, we'll invite you to call in with your thoughts, your questions, your comments about First Amendment cases in this year of 2007. Our guest will be, once again, Howard Schwaber, giving us the latest. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.